Now that Wendy's has these new biggie deals, everyone in the family can get what they're craving, from Nugs to JBCs. The parental units can get an $8 biggie bundle, the eldest who think they're so grown can get a $6 biggie bag, and the little one who can do no wrong can get a $4 biggie bites. You know, assuming they have a credit card. No, I'm kidding. We take cash too. $4, $6, and $8 biggie deals for the whole family. Only at Wendy's.
Price and participation may vary. Single items at regular price. Prices may be higher in Alaska, California, and Hawaii.
I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show with Bob Zimmerman. From the surface of the planet Earth, we're getting in a time machine going back to July 1969. An event, the landing on the moon, that was a credit to everyone who worked on the effort at NASA, everyone who worked on creating the astronaut corps, but especially three men. Neil Armstrong, the first man on the moon, Buzz Aldrin, his companion co-pilot for the very exciting and risk-taking landing and ascent from the moon, and then Michael Collins, the man who remained in the command craft, knowing that if something happened on the surface, he'd go home alone. Bob has written extensively about the moon landings and the race and all of the missions. And so I asked Bob Zimmerman to come on of Behind the Black to reflect upon Michael Collins and all three of them, really, and what we lived through on that day in July in 1969. Bob, good evening to you. Michael Collins, gone, but how do we remember him, Bob?
Well, I was fortunate in writing Genesis, the story of Apollo 8, and then later when I wrote Leaving Earth, there were questions that needed to be asked about the Apollo missions and the space program. And then when I was writing later in Leaving Earth, there was also research that I needed to do with the Air and Space Museum. And Michael Collins was one of the friendliest, easygoing, nicest astronauts I ever had to deal with. He was always, you got in touch with him no matter who you were, and he responded instantly. There was no snobbery. There was no, I'm a big deal. Most astronauts are really cool people anyway, but this guy was special. He just simply, you felt like he was your friend when you spoke to him immediately. He was always open and outgoing in a very humorous, lighthearted, friendly manner. And that, I think, was necessary on the crew of Apollo 11 going to the moon, because you had Neil Armstrong, the ultimate serious pilot, very calm, very to the point, but very to the point, very focused on landing. And you had Buzz Aldrin, who at that time was somewhat mercurial and passionate and also good at what he did. But, you know, there was a lot of emotional energy there, and I think Mike Collins balanced the two very well. And he was the guy they chose to sit in the Apollo capsule while it orbited the moon, while they went down and stayed for a day or so and then came back. And as he wrote in his really wonderful autobiography, Carrying the Fire, he was then, when he went behind the moon especially, he was the loneliest person in the history of the human race, because he said there were billions plus two on the other side, billions on the Earth and two on the moon, and he all by himself on the moon's far side, out of touch with everybody. And then, of course, there was always the fear, as you mentioned, that they would not, that there would be something wrong on the moon and these guys would not get back, would not be able to take off, or when they did take off, there would be some issue with docking again. This is, you know, really, it had only been done really once before in lunar orbit on the Apollo 10 mission. And so there was that risk that they would not return to him, and the only way they could get back to Earth was on the command module, and then he'd be forced to come home alone. He feared that, but it didn't happen. They all came back. And he expressed these ideas in his book and his writing and in creating the Air and Space Museum. That's how I dealt with him later, because in doing research, because maybe the most important contribution he made after the flight was he became head of the Air and Space Museum, Smithsonian, in D.C., and he really was the one who turned that museum into one of the most popular in the world in telling the history of all aviation and all space exploration up until today. And he was the one that made it happen that way. And once again, it has a lot to do with his personality. He brought people in from everywhere, and it reflects his open, gentle, positive nature the way that museum was designed during and after his lifetime.
I want to recover the fact, Bob, that this was his second mission. There were two missions, and Apollo 11 was his second mission. He performed, I've read about these things, he performed a space rendezvous in the first mission, Gemini 10 in 66, and that was a predicate for the moon mission. They had to be able to pull that off, and did that give Collins the leg up on becoming the of joining Apollo 11, or was it a random choice which one went to the moon?
Deke Slayton, who made the decision on who would go, none of his decisions were random, so no, absolutely not. They were, you know, one of the reasons that Neil Armstrong was chosen to land was because of how he performed on Gemini 8. He performed the first successful docking, but then there was a problem with one of the engines that threw the spacecraft out of control, and he very calmly brought it back under control and brought them back safely to Earth. And so that made him the prime candidate to land. But I think the successful docking Collins
yeah,
was
they
involved
call, they
in.
They call it an orbital rendezvous, which sounds difficult when you're doing it the first time.
And it is difficult. It's not natural. The rendezvous took many. It took almost the entire Gemini program, 12 missions, to finally get that done. And Gemini 8, and it really wasn't until Gemini 10 that they had a successful docking. And on top of that, he did two spacewalks on that mission. He was the first to actually repeat a spacewalk in space. And I think his calm demeanor, more than anything else, though, was I think the key. When Slayton was trying to put together the crews, he could see that this would be a good combination of men, and so that's why he chose him. And he should be remembered as an Aldrin and Armstrong. But I want to also mention something very important, John. You said NASA did this, and I always want to emphasize there were probably 100,000 companies and millions of Americans who contributed to building this system because NASA didn't do it. They've hired Americans to do it for them. So this was an achievement of the entire nation. And the astronauts talked about this repeatedly, including Collins in his book, that behind him, he was standing on the shoulders of giants, he said. Behind him was all the people who made every unit and every piece, 10,000s of pieces, come together and work so that he could go to the moon and come back.
Bob, how did they do it with that computer? I've always puzzled. Once I read, what did it have? 120K bytes?
It's less than that. All right. If you happen to have, many people don't wear watches anymore, but if you happen to have an old Casio digital watch with a little calculator on it, that has more memory and computer capability than the computer that was on the Apollo capsule. And this was really spectacular work by astronauts and human beings. For example, when I wrote Genesis, the story of Apollo 8, and I was going through the transcripts of that mission, the first to go to the moon, orbit the moon, and come back, which, by the way, they gave a 50-50 chance of success and did it anyway. I'm reading the transcripts, and there's periods periodically where the ground reads off a long sequence of numbers. I mean, we're talking about a lot of numbers. They read like five off, and another five, and another five, and then the man on the astronaut on board the ship would read them back. What they were doing is the big, big computers on Earth would do all the calculations, and what they would have to do then is plug those numbers into their computer on board to run the engines and fire them. Now, they always could supersede the rocket engines by hand, but they preferred for some firings to let the astronaut do it, let the computer do it first and just act as a backup. But they had to read those numbers over from the ground and then enter them. And the fact is, they never made a mistake. These astronauts, the most remarkable thing about all of them is that in the Apollo program, in the Gemini program, and in the Mercury program, there was literally no human error. It's really remarkable, the statement of how good these guys were.
What are your two books, Bob? Name them again.
Genesis, Story of Apollo 8, that's basically the history of the 60s space race. It's focused on the Apollo 8 mission that orbited the moon for the first time, and they read from the Bible on Christmas Eve. And that mission was actually the winner of the space race. For most of the people involved at NASA and in the Soviet Union at the time, The landing was actually just simply the period on the explanation point. The mission that won the race was Apollo 8 orbiting the moon. And the other book was Leaving Earth, which is basically a post-Apollo manned history story, and it's mostly about actually the Soviet Russians almost entirely, because it's basically the story of how they came up with the idea and successfully achieved the first successful space stations in orbit, multiple space stations, and were trying to learn how to build interplanetary spaceships. It wasn't just them, of course. The Americans tried to do it at the same time. But from 73 on until the 90s, it was the Soviets all by themselves running the show.
Bob Zimmerman. He keeps the website Behind the Black. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show.
Hi, Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Boto Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto, it's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.